Welcome to the Dolly Seller Master. I'm your host, Jochen Heusner, and today I'm excited to talk to an incredibly knowledgeable wine personality who knows the world of wine from many perspectives, Keith Granger. Keith is an esteemed wine educator and actually a founding member of the Association of Wine Educators. He's a consultant winemaker and an author of several books on wine, for which he has won the Gourmand Award for the best wine education book in the world. Actually, he has just published his latest work, Wine Faults and Flaws, and we'll be talking about this, of course. But first, thank you for joining me today, Keith.
Good afternoon, Jochen. Good afternoon, everybody.
Well, I provided a very brief summary of you and of the many hats you're wearing. So to do your wealth of knowledge and expertise some justice, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Right. I came into wine as a second career, as many people did, and including Jochen himself, of course. There's, to my mind, as far as wine making, wine consultancy, wine science is concerned, there are two ways in. And the way people tend to do it nowadays, of course, is they study science at school, go to university, get a first class honours degree in something like organic chemistry, and then go on to study oenology and then into winemaking. I have nothing against that approach, but it is, of course, by definition, a scientific approach. I come from a very different background. In fact, I'm a failed musician. I say that in so much as when I went to school, secondary school, all I ever wanted to be was a musician, a trumpet player and a composer, and did all the usual routes, did all the exams, the Royal School of Music, and was getting merits and distinctions all the time. And I thought I was pretty damn good. However, I was brought up in a fairly small town in the Home Counties in England, about 30 miles north of London. And then I went to London to study. And suddenly I thought, God, these are musicians. Here are real people. These are people who understand music in a way which I never will. Now, I'm talking classical music, of course. There is no second division in classical music. If you are not brilliant, you are nothing at all. And you will probably finish up teaching in a comprehensive school and going home every night and tearing your hair out. And I certainly did not want to go down that road. So I had the very good sense of giving up my classical music aspirations pretty early. I still listen a great deal to classical music. I love opera, love Puccini, love Verdi. And I also love people who are very much transitioning from classical music to other forms. So I'm going back many years, we could look at people like Leonard Bernstein, who wrote West Side Story, of course, I said perhaps his most famous work, which was a mixture of classical, jazz, pop, you name it, it was all in there. And perhaps more recently, and sadly died only quite recently, Ennio Morricone, who is famous for film scores, particularly the ones he did for the spaghetti westerns, who also happened to be a brilliant trumpet player and a great conductor. So, in fact, I say I gave up my aspirations of classical music very early, but did go into music in so much as I worked for a while for a music publishing company as a professional manager. The professional manager, the people who get copyrights and sort of market the copyrights. And I formed my own small music publishing company. And in fact, we also had a couple of record shops just to be at the sharp end. And this, I'm going back now to the mid-1970s through to the very early 1980s. Had a couple of minor hits. I used to do a little bit of record production as it was in those days. It was great fun. Sometimes earned some money, sometimes lost a good deal of money. While I was doing this, I got very interested in wine. And in fact, a number of us formed a wine buying consortium so as we could hopefully buy better wines and get together for tastings and actually be once in a blue moon having a bottle of Chateau Margaux or even prime Burgundy, and got more and more into wine. So additionally, I woke up one day and said, I don't want to do music anymore, full stop. And in fact, I haven't picked my trumpet up since then. So I became a wine buyer, finishing up as a buyer for a company in the Midlands And one of the things I'm proud to say is that we were the first company in the Midlands, the United Kingdom, who listed any Australian wines at all. At that time, the total amount of Australian wine sold in Great Britain was 50,000 cases. You know, so it was absolutely nothing. And while I wouldn't say that I was influential in expanding sales in Great Britain, certainly I did have a small part to play. So into wine buying, and then wanted to sort of learn more. So I started off the easy ways, or seemed easy at first, with the WSET courses through the level 2, 3, and 4 diploma. I then started doing short courses with a more scientific basis. So did some short courses in Bordeaux and, sort of moved into wine from art. And I'm going to come back to trying to link music and wine, or even painting and wine, or writing novels. Let's go to cooking. And here's perhaps an easy example. Most chefs know virtually no food science. That makes them great chefs, or is one of the ingredients for being a great chef. Most artists, painters, know very little about paint and what have you. They certainly know about perspective and many things like that. What I'm saying is that they're not coming from a scientific background. Now, I've learnt my science as I've gone along, partially on a need-to-know basis, which I personally think is a very good way of learning. A good example would be that if I need to find an ATM, a cash machine in a certain town, and someone says, oh, you go to so-and-so, you turn left, you turn right, and you go down the street, by the time I've got there, probably don't know even where I'm going. If I find it myself, I remember exactly where it is every time I go back. So I believe need to know is a very good way of learning, which of course eventually takes one into research, because you find that you need a more scientific background for what you're doing. And I think that's led me basically to where I am today. As you said already, I do some consultant winemaking. Firstly, I started doing wine education. As you said, I'm a founder member of the Association of Wine Educators. That was right back in 1993. And the idea for that was many people were receiving very low-class information on wine, perhaps from the manager of their local Lodbins branch or something. And they, there was often an agenda. We founded Associated Wine Educators with the idea that people would have access, be they consumers or trade professionals, to independent wine education. The association likes to use the word objective. I don't believe there is such a thing as objectivity. You can look at objectivity in many different ways. Is it a universal truth? Is it just trying to get rid of all bias and all prejudice? Two different ways there. If we say that it's trying to get rid of all bias and prejudice, that's a great aspiration, but we will never, ever achieve it. That's all it can ever be. If it's a universal truth, how do we know it's a truth? You can climb a peak and get to the top, you know, I think that's it. Then there's another one just around the corner there almost, you know. So I think objectivity as such doesn't exist. So as I started in wine education, moved to wine writing and more serious wine writing. I don't write shopping lists. There are so many so-called writers, or they say this one's on offer this week at X, Y, or Z supermarket, and it tastes a bit like that. I cannot see the point. I try and give people the tools to make their own decisions. And from there, moved into winemaking and consultant winemaking. Used to do some in South Africa. I don't anymore. I still do consultant winemaking in Turkey, particularly near the Bulgarian border. There's an area known as Thrace or Trakya or Marmara, depending exactly where you were. Do some winemaking there. And that is great because that in many ways is a European, I'm going to say Bordeaux climate. I mean, that isn't accurate because it's continental rather than than by the sea, but using European varieties, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cabernet Franc, Chardonnay, Semillon, etc. More challenge I do some in Northern Cyprus, which is the unofficial part of Cyprus, and I've been involved in the project there, in fact, since its instigation, since first seeking out land back in 2000. First vintage was 2004. All sorts of challenges, that gets particularly hot. My principal is there at the moment and says it's 40 degrees, or at least it was yesterday. Lots of pests, which I'd never, ever read about. You get European hornets coming in. And if I decide that we should be picking on Monday, you can guarantee on Saturday and Sunday, they'll be in there like an army and devastating the vineyard, leaving behind a seed and a shell. And many other challenges, we suffer quite badly there from mildews. And the biggest challenge of all is actually with local people, in so much as they have little faith. They've always believed that Cyprus was a country where you make cheap wine, as much as possible of it. And that's what it's all about. So when we're trying to make high quality wine, of course, and then, of course, trying to get people to pay a reasonable price for high-quality wine, that isn't so easy. Having said that, almost the entire market is in Cyprus, particularly directly to consumers, but also to restaurants. I better catch breath, I think.
Yeah, that must be very difficult. It's like to get this kind of like a change of paradigm that you convince people that actually there is like there's this whole work that you have to put into it to produce quality, high quality wine will eventually pay off. And if like the culture is like that, I assume that it's very difficult to change that kind of mindset.
It is. And I look at countries who've had a roller coaster. If you take Germany, for example, now if we go back to the 1970s, 80s, Germany used to be the number one source by volume of white wine in the United Kingdom. Most of it was rubbish, the so-called Liebfrau, Milchner, Steinebutter, Domtal, Breitbein, Kassel, Peaceport, Michelsberg, etc., etc., often regarded as sugar water. Certainly the fine German estates did sell their wine, not a great deal. And of course, Germany never really had a plan B. So all these very poor vineyards on the flatland, which have been planted with Müller-Thurgau for all these cheap and cheerful sugar water wines, when people in Britain use the expression grew up, let's just say grew out of that type of wine, you know, then volumes contracted. Certainly there's still fine German wine available in the United Kingdom. You'll only see one or two bottles on any supermarket shelf. So what had been the number one source for white wine slipped right down the league table. Other countries, and Bulgaria. Bulgaria made its reputation on selling other European lookalikes. From whites, they were doing Chardonnay, Cancrum, and region, for example, for red, Suindal, Cabernet Sauvignon. And we were sold to people who wanted to maybe have a bit of white Burgundy but couldn't afford it or didn't want to pay the price. And the same with Bordeaux. I know in my days when I was a buyer, we used to import some of those wines. And some of our private clients, we sold mostly to the trade, but some of the private clients, I know would buy three cases of Suindal Cabernet and a bottle of Laveau Poifere. And I was quite sure that on the dinner parties, the Suindal Cabernet was going into the Laveau Poifere bottle. other countries, though, if we look at Eastern Europe elsewhere, Romania still has a down market image. There are some good Romanian wines. Slovenia, actually, I've got a lot of time for, because they are trying to go in at a higher end and they're still selling very small quantities, but they realise that you cannot go, if I talk in euros for you, you cannot go for selling your wine at sort of 3-4 euros to selling your wine at 30 euros. People won't take that hike. If you come in at 20 euros, then you can always adjust up a bit or down a bit as suits the market.
Yeah, it's interesting, especially with the example of Slovenia. And I've been to a tasting 2 years ago of in Italy, and it was very interesting. And obviously, it's like with the white wines of Friuli that have like a very high reputation, next on reputation. And then if you actually go to the areas, it's just like you just cross the border every 5 minutes, and it's like the vineyards are on the border in the Collio, yes. And there is no real difference between the two, you would think, but it's obviously
I mean, I love northeastern Italy. I know that's where you are. I love Sud Tirol, Veneto, Friuli Venezia Giulia, especially Friuli. In many ways, it's like Tuscany, but at half the price. But the terrain is very different. And the first time I went from Gorizia over to Slovenia, and I was talking to someone on the phone. I said, "Oh, what's the time difference there?" I said, "About 100 years." And it really was very, very different. Love it completely.
No. Certainly, it was like, I was more thinking about like the those winemakers, this Friulian winemakers that have like basically vineyards on both sides of the border, and it's like I've been there several times. Enough, it's a wonderful area. But like you mentioned, like the challenge that you have to get this shift in mindset, and it's like an Alto Adige, Sud Tirol, in many ways is similar, because like they in the 80s had to realize that like they had to change from doing a lot of bulk wine or selling it in liter bottles here. It's like they've made the change towards quality, and this is what they're known for nowadays, and really has paid off.
Yeah, definitely. As you mentioned bulk wine, I'll just make an observation here, because there is a big move at the moment for people shipping wine in bulk, in flexi tanks, in ISO tanks, etc., and bottling at destination rather than at source. And there are many reasons given: environmental, you know, reducing carbon footprint, etc., is one. I often think people give those reasons as an excuse for saving money. I personally, once it comes to fine wine, are very much one for bottling at source, and something I touch on in the Faults and Flaws book. And a number of reasons. Firstly, if you're going to bottle a destination, you have to stabilise the wine twice, once for its journey, before it goes into flexi tank, ISO tank, etc. Then, of course, the bottler has to stabilise the wine again, adjusting the free sulphur dioxide, etc. That means that what happens at that point is out of the control of the producer. It also means that there's a double handling operation. And one of the problems, of course, that can lead to wine faults can be oxygen pickup. And while most of the bottlers I know are very scrupulous, I must say, I think minimal handling is very, very beneficial. So personally, once it comes to fine wine, I am very much still in favour of bottling at source.
And you already built us a bridge here. By talking about wine faults, so we can talk about your latest book, Wine Faults and Flaws. I'll say right away, it's a great book. It's like I've read your other books before, and this goes into more detail about this specific topic, and it lists every single wine flaw and fault that I could think of. Obviously, other people,
there are one or two more that
may disagree. But like what I found interesting is that wine production has made such a leap over the last couple of decades in terms of what's happening in the cellar, but also in the vineyard quality wise. Yet we still see some wine falls on the increase despite all those advances in technology. Why is that?
Okay, let me come to that in just a second, doing a politician's answer. One thing I will say straight away, the quality of wines has improved immensely during the last 20 or 30 years. I don't necessarily think that they are better wines, and that might sound to be a paradox. What I'm saying is that from a technical point of view, yes, quality has generally very much improved. Many wines, though, are less drinkable. And we look at the high alcohol levels, the fruit bomb wines, and I can look particularly to California, though they are making strident efforts to restrain that, but elsewhere in the world as well. Now, beyond the scope of today's talk is climate change, which has obviously had an impact on this, but also the move to so-called phenolic ripeness, particularly of red wines. And people have been delaying harvest. I mean, in fact, they're picking earlier a result of climate change, but still delay until they get so-called phenolic ripeness, brown seeds, etc. Which will lead me into your question in just a second. But what I'm going to say is that, to my mind, the diversity of wines has decreased this last 20 years, and wines have become a little bit more globalised and standardised. Is that a bad thing? I think if it's my age, and perhaps it is, you know, for younger people, maybe not. My son loves big, loud, chunky, smack-in-the-mouth reds, you know, and he'll drink those in the same way as I drink beer. But I would have a gentle sip. But that now is going to lead me to really answering your question. What I'm saying is, our faults on the rise or in decline, and the answer is yes, they're on the rise, and yes, they're in decline, depending on what we're talking about. Some faults are in decline, the so-called cork taint, which I think we might talk about a little bit later. The old days of wines showing too much sulfur dioxide, and even oxidation, you know, the wines can have that bitter, you know, sort of cut apple nose and palate. But many other faults are on the increase. The compounds that cause cork taint are actually on the increase due to environmental factors. Retinomyces, which can lead to these sort of farmyard stable elastoplast nose, they're on the increase due, in fact, to winemaking changes. Mycotoxins, which can have health problems in humans, are on the increase. We don't normally taste those. In New World countries, especially, smoke taint is on the increase. Reduced aromas, where wines can finish up smelling like onion and garlic, are on the increase, particularly when the bottles are sealed with screw cap, the so-called post-bottle reduction. Heat damage is on the increase, particularly as wines are getting shipped in bulk and often sitting on docksides for a long while. Why are they increasing from a scientific point of view? Well, firstly is that grapes are, generally speaking, having a higher pH due to, say, climate change, and also this delayed harvesting. Lower acidity. Acidity is the great preservative. pH, higher pH has reduced the effectiveness of sulfur dioxide. The softer style of wines that customers are perceived to want, whether they do actually want them, I might dispute, but certainly the gatekeepers say they do. There's increases in residual sugar in branded wines, so-called entry-level wines. I actually don't like the term entry-level, because a lot of people start there and never move that far from it. But many branded wines, the whites might have up to 10 grams a litre residual sugar, and the reds 5, in one or two cases 10 once again. That is giving a substrate for the growth of fault compounds. People are trying to, the producers are trying to reduce their sulfur dioxide levels from a health perspective, but also because with lower sulfur dioxide actually brings out the fruitiness in wines, perhaps once again to market perceptions. People are bringing wines to market too early. One of the faults, which we might talk about a bit later, is light strike, and bottling white and rosé wines in clear glass and give big problems there. That's very much a growing fault. So yes, all sorts of reasons why faults are on the increase.
And right at the beginning, you already made like a very good point. And it's like, because I think we have to draw a distinction between faults and flaws and what actually constitutes a fault or a flaw. Because you mentioned bread. I think we could also use TDN in Riesling, the petrol note. What actually constitutes a fault? It's like, where do we draw the line?
That's a very tricky one. And in case of some compounds, straightforward. If we look at the haloanisoles, which cause so-called corkiness, if they are present in wine at anything above trace level, it is always a fault, even if you cannot taste or smell them. Now, I said we'll perhaps talk about this a little bit later, but these compounds give wines a musty nose, a damp sack nose, sometimes mushroom, fungal, etc., if they're at a perceivable level. But if they're in wine at below perceivable level, they still mute the fruitiness. So to my mind, haloanisoles in wine are always a fault, full stop. But other things, not necessarily so. And Brett is one you've mentioned already. Brett can give wines a little bit of interest, a bit of spice, a little bit of that sort of Indian market, all sorts of fascinating overtones to the wine. But it is a matter of level plus the wine matrix. So in one wine, it would be okay. In another wine, it won't be. So I would say the definition really in some ways is a compound that is in wine at the wrong concentration, in the wrong place, and in the wrong wine, and probably at the wrong time, because sometimes the compound can be great at a certain time, but not at others.
We all already, as I said, I think TDN is another good example on that. And it's like, I'm personally, I kind of quite like that petrol note in aged Rieslings. For me, it's something that is just part of that specific wine. But obviously that's also a question of culture, I suppose. And we touched on that a little bit earlier, before this call. And you were saying it's very much a cultural divide between the so-called old world and the new world.
Very much. But even within Europe, there can be cultural divides as well. We talked about Brett a little bit earlier now, to a new world wine producer, certainly to an Australian and almost certainly to a Californian. Any hint of Brett in a wine is a fault, probably a serious fault. I might regard it sometimes as a flaw, depending on level, which leads us into TDN. Now, TDN is what gives Riesling, particularly mature Riesling, the kerosene, paraffin, diesel, petrol aromas. It's usually present in warmer climates and warmer vintages, and especially where there's high sunlight exposure. It actually comes from the grapes, and it's due to enzymatic and acid catalyzed reactions. I'm not going to go too much into detailed science here. And certainly climate change has elevated TDN levels in recent years. It can be reduced, I say, by good canopy management. Interestingly enough, there's been a lot of controversy over the last 20, 25 years on closures and the battle between natural cork, other cork-based closures, and the screw cap. What is interesting is that cork can act like blotting paper and can actually absorb TDN from a wine. And I've had some wines which have been sealed with cork closure, and the producers also bottled the same wine under screw cap. And after maybe 5 years in bottle, the TDN in the screw cap has been overt, perhaps in some cases overpowering, while in the case of the cork closure has been muted, and the fruitiness of the wine comes out. But I do think that it is something that can send a shiver down the spine. It can be a sign of good mature Riesling. Particularly in Germany. Alsace, of course, can have very high levels of TDN, especially in some of the Vendange Tardive wines or Selection de the Grand Nob.
Since you mentioned cork, and cork is when you talk to anyone about wine falls, and it's like the first one that anyone I think would mention is obviously that the cork problem, which has been on the decrease over the last decade or so, I suppose, in numbers. And this is always interesting. I was going to ask you that, but I'm not sure. It's like, if you have an answer, what a good estimate actually would be. And it's like, I think there's the numbers in your book, and then obviously depends on who you're asking, and people are sometimes a bit biased. But what I would actually like you to ask you is, like, maybe it's like, you can, because it's not just cork. It's the question about haloisinols, PCA, TCP is obviously much more complex. Maybe you can do a little summary.
Estimates as to the economic cost of the wine industry vary very widely. The most recent figure I cite in the book is from the final report for the NCORC, that's electronic nose to detect haloanisoles in cork stoppers project, which was funded by the EU to the tune of pretty much €1 million. They said that the cost, annual cost to EU wine producers, is probably in the region of €700 million. Some other figures I found from much earlier put the cost globally to somewhere between €1 billion and €10 billion. Most of those figures come from the peak of so-called cork tainting wine. What perhaps is more interesting is the cost to individual producers, because we're looking not just at an economic cost here, but a reputational cost. And sometimes there's been a very high price to pay. And I cite quite a few examples in the book, many of which come from a few years ago, but the problem hasn't gone away. So if we were to look at Bordeaux, and I believe I can state these without getting sued, because these examples are going to have been fairly widely reported. Back in the very late 1980s and early 1990s, a number of Bordeaux chateaux had huge problems of hail anisoles being in the cellars, being in the cuvery. And the people would open a bottle of wine and say, this wine is corked, okay? Mm-hmm. And the cause, I cannot say it was never the case in an individual case, wasn't usually the cork, it was due entirely to cellar contamination with hail anisoles. And I just want to give the basic reason for that. And the Bordeaux provides quite a good example. Bordeaux, let's go from sort of the Bordeaux 1855 classification right through to about 1982 or so, had in many ways been in the doldrums, and certainly in the interwar years, and the investment in properties had been minimal. Mm. I know some of the properties I used to go to in the early 1980s, you know, they were ramshackle, to put it bluntly. And I'm not just talking petit chateau, I'm actually talking some Grand Cru Classé here as well. Then suddenly, starting really with the 1982 vintage, which was a great vintage, money started coming in for all sorts of reasons. And one of which was, of course, the Americans turned on to fine wine. Now, I'm not sure how many American listeners you got, and I hope I don't set any of them saying what I do, but on my age, I always talk openly. Americans had no real history of drinking fine wine. Of course, we go back to the early 20th century, they had Prohibition. In the interwar years, after Prohibition was repealed, wine started coming back. We do a sweet wine. It was fortified wine. Gallows, you know, came on the scene and started making good money doing this. And this went on. And largely until one Robert Parker Jr. came on the scene with his Wine Advocate and started turning Americans, rich Americans, onto fine wine, because they were told what was good from the source that they could trust, i.e. another American. And he would use, because the 100-point system, which they were used to from their school exams, etc. So the importance of Parker in turning America onto fine wine, and Bordeaux, other regions as well, but thereby giving money for people to reinvest in their properties, cannot be underestimated. So they started reinvesting in the properties, and quite often, you know, meant an entire stripping out of the shay, the barrel cellars, the cuveries, etc. And the buildings got re-timbered, and the timbers they were using were treated with wood preservatives. And the wood preservatives contain either bromophenols or chlorophenols, which are the precursors of hail anisoles. Mm. And then as soon as you get some damp and some filamentous fungi, that immediately makes airborne the hail anisole compounds, which of course migrate in the wine at a million and one opportunities. Mm. So going back to the late 80s and early 90s, a good example, Chateau du Cru Bocaille suffered dreadfully. In fact, in the end, they had to have their shay completely rebuilt. Chateau Latour suffered, Chateau Canon suffered. These are just examples, many, many others as well. It wasn't just Bordeaux, other parts of France. Go to America, many cellars suffered as well. Chateau Montelena, which had, you know, got this huge Judgment of Paris success in 75. By the 1990s, their cellar had hail anisoles in, and Hansall, etc., many others. South America, Irajuritz, etc., or just back to North America, Gallo Sonoma, their top wine, suffered badly. I remember in the early 1980s, I was tutoring a number of tastings on behalf of Gallo Sonoma. And I knew much less then than I do now, obviously. There's a, God, you've got to get your cork sorted out, you know. And of course, it wasn't cork at all. It was cellar contamination. So the reputational damage can live on and live on. And I often see on blogs and that people saying, I've never touched one of these wines since I had problems X years ago, of course. And cellar contamination still exists. And I will not name names this time, but I know at least one, probably two Grand Cru Classés in Bordeaux that have a problem with haloanisoles in the cellar. So it hasn't entirely gone away.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the reputational issue, and it's obviously, it's like, I mean, even if you don't taste it, and I think that's even worse than when you really have a strong cork hold, and you recognize it, you could easily just like believe that the wine you're tasting is just not to your personal taste. You just, it's not good enough.
And especially with concentrations at very low levels. And I just want to talk technically just for 1 second. The sensory detection of TCA, which is the most common haloanisole in wine, depending on the wine matrix in still wine, is somewhere between 1.4 and 1.3 nanograms a litre. Now, a nanogram is a part per trillion. So I want to put that in some sort of perspective. One part per trillion is like looking at 1 grain of wheat in 100,000 tonnes, or the equivalent of 1 sugar cube in 60 Olympic-sized swimming pools. Tiny, tiny amounts will taint the wine. In sparkling wine, the perception thresholds are even lower. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and if you can't smell it, you can't taste it, you may well be muting the fruitiness, as I said earlier.
You just explained, like, how little is required to actually completely ruin a wine. So the question, I suppose, is like, how can you really eradicate the problem once you've identified it in a cellar? Or is it like
You can eradicate it in individual wines, and obviously, of course, to get rid of it from a cellar requires entire stripping out of the cellar, particularly anything that contains cellulose, and that would, of course, include all wood, etc. So, yes, it can be eradicated. Just before we I detail that, though, I should point out that haloanisoles are an increasing problem globally, not just in wine. Also affect beer, prepackaged vegetables and things like those, bags of ready-to-eat carrot sticks, water, tap water. Beijing has a big problem with what I'm going to call corked water. Pharmaceuticals, some of the big manufacturers, Pfizer, for example, have had to withdraw pharmaceuticals several times, flour, rice, sultanas, you name it. And it is a growing problem. I was at a tasting in London before the lockdown, tasting some wines from Larry Cherubino, great Australian producer. And Larry picked up a glass, poured a wine and said, "Larry, this wine's tainted, you know, haloanisole cork." "No, it's not. Wine's from the same bottle." And of course, the glass had been washed in London tap water. And immediately that gave the illusion of corkiness to the wine. So haloanisoles are going to be a problem for a long, long time. Yeah. You can still get it as a result of cork. Now, cork used to be the major source, particularly in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and up to the early 2000s. And I promise you this isn't a harangue against science. I gave you my lead into science earlier. But the problem started in the years just before the Second World War. And the companies Dow and Monsanto play a part here, in so much as they were creating herbicides, fungicides, pesticides from chlorophenols. Now, chlorophenols are not naturally present. They're only there as a result of the hand of man. Bromophenols, which can also give cork-like taste, can be found naturally caused by brown algae, but chlorophenols don't. And if we'd have looked ahead, you know, rather if they'd have looked ahead, the problems with chlorophenols should have been obvious. They're worldwide pollutants. Now they're largely banned. They certainly are carcinogenic, but people didn't look ahead. Looking at writings from the 1970s, and one guy, Christian Bankahay, who used to be the sommelier at the Paris restaurant, was it called Pont de la Tour? He said that in the 1970s, they'd be opening 1,000 bottles a week and maybe have 3 or 4 corked bottles, which would always be wines for the 1960s or early 70s, not the ones from the 20s, 30s or 40s. I could argue, and people might counter me on this one, that corked wine did not exist as we know it before the Second World War. Having said that, George Saintsbury, who wrote a work called Notes on the Cellar Book, refers to cork wine in the 1920s. But was he talking the same things as we are today, or was he just talking different odours that have come from cork? But what I was going to say is the cork industry, which certainly did have a part to play. They were washing, they were bleaching cork planks in recycled tap water, which contains chlorine. Chlorine equals chlorophenols equals chloranisoles. They were bleaching cork with chlorine, and their working practices, certainly from the 1970s to 1990s, left a lot to be desired. They cleaned up their act no end. And in fact, the top producers now, I'll cite Amarin as an example, is the largest cork producer in the world. Now on their top range cork, actually give a guarantee that there'll be no detectable TCA in those corks.
I was wondering, when I read that in your book, what are we talking about price-wise? What's the cost of a cork that gives that guarantee compared to...
They can come expensive, anything up to €1 a cork, depending actually on the grade of cork as well, as opposed to maybe sort of 20, 25 cents. Now, of course, if you're selling wine at €3 or €4 a bottle, that's clearly unaffordable. On the other hand, if you are selling fine wine that people are going to sell, it has to be a price well worth paying.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's like in this, I don't want to get into like the whole dispute between cork closures and screw caps and all the different alternatives. You've written an entire part on that as well in the book. So it's like, as I said, like there are, everything's in there, and we can't cover it all, but I said I would like to cover a few points. We briefly
just before you move on, you did ask me and haven't answered yet how wineries can prevent it, and also can they treat it. Basically, in the winery, a lot of it's down to good hygiene. Make sure molds and fungi are removed. Not to use chlorine as a cleaner. Lots of breweries do, of course, and some wineries now have breweries attached or bromine. Monitor your tap water, get good air, humidity control, prohibit anything that might contain chlorophenols. That includes some plastics. Screen all your processing aids, things like bentonite, because they absorb the haloanisoles like no tomorrow, and lots of testings. Can you treat the wines? Just about. Some of these are very controversial. Not all are permitted by the OIV, who set the rules for global wine production in nearly all countries. The USA and China aren't part of it. But there are various methods of treating without adsorbing polymers. And polyvinylidene chloride, which is a bit like PVC, not quite the same, and yeast hulls, etc. But obviously, the way is not to have the problem in the first place.
And it obviously remains like a massive problem elsewhere. It's like you just described. This is very, very fascinating, and it's going to be interesting how it develops in that space as well. As I said, I just wanted to focus, getting back to the book, on a couple of the falls, and bread is one that we've already touched upon, but I thought it's like it would be worth getting back into it, because this is one of those wonderful examples where in like in a very small dose can add to the complexity of wines. Obviously, we also said it's a question of culture, but like talking percentage wise, how big an issue is that actually?
Right. I cannot give you definitive figures. All I can say is that in some regions, the problem is reducing, and in others, it's increasing. and the reasons it's increasing are those I gave earlier of higher pH in wines, lower acidity, often residual sugar in entry-level wines. People are trying to give these soft, round, easy-drinking wines. Perhaps just a little bit of background might help. Firstly, Rhett is a genus of yeast, and it can come into winery on grapes, although there's some dispute how much actually comes from grapes and how much is endemic in the winery. So it's a desirable attribute, very much depends on the concentration, the wine matrix. So in Pinot Noir, I would say, generally speaking, it is undesirable. Having said that, because fashion comes into play, and Anthony Hansen, Burgundy expert, in his book Burgundy, first edition was 1982, is famously quoted saying, "Great Burgundy smells of shit." In other words, all the Brett odours, which you particularly don't want. By the second edition, he was already finding it objectionable and saying it was down to microbial activity. It is very, very tricky. Australia has cleaned up its wines no end. They had big problems in the early 2000s with very bretty wines, including some famous producers. And once again, this is documented, so I don't think I'll get sued. Kate Mentel, for example, from Margaret River. Now, in those days, I was going to Western Australia at least once a year, and I got to know the then winemaker, John Durham, very well. And he was trying desperately to clean up Brett from his wines. And whenever I said this wine's a bit Bretty, you could see the look of horror on his face. But partially due to the activities of the Australian Wine Research Institute, they've managed to largely eliminate Brett from Australian wineries, at least those who want to. There are one or two who thinks it gives a lovely funky note, those tones which can add, as I said earlier, a little bit of spice, you know, to a little bit of bacon to the breakfast. What I would say, and I appreciate that we haven't got all afternoon to discuss this, is that some brewers love Brett. In fact, the name Brett actually comes from a British fungus, which was first discovered in beer in 1904 by scientist Clausen, who worked at the Carlsberg Brewery. And he thought that Brett gave British beers their great carry, British beers as was. But many brewers today still love Brett, particularly people who are brewing lambic-type beers, cool ship ales, and et cetera. Rodenbach Grand Cru would be a good example of a lambic beer that's got its very character due to Brett. And one or two wineries are embracing it as well. There's a crazy winemaker, Mandy Helt Donovan, who's with a winery called Marisi in California, produces a Pinot Gris wine, Manic White. Now, I must say straight away, Brett, you normally define, particularly in red wines, it's much less the case in whites, but you can find it in sparkling. But Mandy is deliberately making this this Manic White Pinot Gris, and she describes it as a wine fermented intentionally with Brettanomyces, bottled fresh, slightly spritzy, exotic aromas like cider, a humble story of a yeast trying to make good.
But can you actually, I mean, like, how big is the risk that the whole thing spins out of control? Can you control fermentation not at all?
Very, very tricky, at least today. And this perhaps lies in the future. There's been some research of what are good and bad strains of Brett. And some scientists, even, for example, Linda Bisson at University of California, Davis, actually thinks that we will be able to control Brett. And she's not totally against it. Once again, she's somewhat older, and perhaps this also isn't just a cultural thing, isn't just a fashion thing, perhaps it's also an age thing, and young people now are used to those fresh, bright, vibrant, fruity flavours which Brett detracts from.
Yeah. It's fascinating, and it was actually the first time I ever heard about it when you, in your book, that winemakers are toying with Brett as a tool on purpose.
So, yeah, most tainted, I must say. I mean, it's the crazy guys, you know, which perhaps brings me on to, and this is a little bit of a tricky one. as to whether faulty wines can be excellent. And we haven't really got into discussing the difference between fault and flaws. Yeah. But I just want to read you a tasting note written by Lisa Perotti-Brown, master of wine, who writes for, she's editor for Robert Parker's Wine Advocate. And here's a tasting note of the wine. Ethyl acetate, fault compound. Acid aldehyde, fault compound. High volatile acidity, fault. Along with beautiful, rich, mature fruit, wine tastes delicious. And she's describing a Nicolas Joly wine, 2000 vintage Clos de la Bergerie, Sauvignon Rochamoine. Now, Nicolas Joly is a biodynamic winemaker. He's loved and hated in equal measures. The scientists, the oenologists hate him, reckon every wine he's ever made is faulty. And of course, people who like wines with character often think that he's God.
It's a tricky one. Let's put it this way. Maybe to conclude, like the few hand selected examples of faults that we wanted to discuss today, maybe we can conclude that with Light Strike, which you already alluded to. And what is it exactly, and why is it on the increase?
Right, Light Strike. Let me say first away, only affects wines in clear glass bottles. It affects whites, it can affect rosé, more so whites. It's caused by volatile sulfur compounds and due to the transmission of light through clear glass. Now, particularly on rosé and on sweet white wines, the marketing people love to bottle in clear glass. Of course, green glass and rosé just do not look good, and I fully understand that. So it's found in wines that have been exposed to UV light and some visible light at low wavelengths. And how severe it is will depend on the spectrum, the intensity, the radiation duration, the optical properties of the bottle, and the light absorbing species and the composition of the wine. So clear glass is the danger, light wavelengths, 370 to 440 nanometers. And clear glass only filters out 10% of UV light. Green glass between 50 and 90%, and brown glass between 90 and 99%. Now, I'm pleased to say, in fact, that Italian producers for red wines love brown glass, many of them, as over green glass. And without doubt, brown glass is best. Can affect sparkling wines and disaster, of course, for people who got their bottles of Louis Roederer Cristal they've been given in the foil wrap and felt that the foil looked a bit tatty, and the foil, of course, is a barrier to the light strike. Take it out, put it on the kitchen work surface under their fluorescent tubes, etc., and then say that the wine tastes of light strike. It stinks, it tastes garlicky, it tastes sulfury, etc., etc. It is a growing problem. This happens in restaurants as well. Supermarket shelves. I've seen on supermarkets, particularly on sweet wines, adjacent bottles, one of which looks nice and light in colour, other one of which looks very dark. And this is your first warning sign of light strike. If a white wine looks unexpectedly dark, or a rosé wine starts looking orange in colour, it is a big, big problem. There are ways, it's very complicated, of trying to reduce it in the winemaking process. Really, to my mind, the answer would be either keep your wines in the dark, of course, is nigh impossible on the supermarket shelf, or have them bottled in coloured glass. Lightweight bottles allow more glass to pass, and of course, the environmental lobby says we should be bottling in lightweight bottles as well. If ever I buy a good wine in a supermarket, I normally get the guy say, have you got an unopened case from out the back, if it's bottled in clear glass, and go for that one.
No, it's certainly interesting, and it's an answer. It's like it's one answer, and every fault and flaw is different, why some faults are in increase. And I suppose you can summarize it to the fact that despite understanding where it comes from, the marketing or the market demand drives it into a wrong direction. But like, yeah, it's, the question is, what do you prefer? Do you prefer it in a transparent bottle, or do you prefer it in a brown bottle, which might not look as nice, but...
Of course, but I think as well, there are two contrasting disciplines in winemaking, and one of which is technical excellence, what I will call scientific excellence. Another is minimal intervention. Yeah. And people very often, you know, say, are you using natural yeast? Of course, you know, which can be absolutely fantastic. There's all sorts of expressions of terroir as well, but obviously might not necessarily be as controllable as people like, you know, are you not using it, any enzymes? I mean, one of the things that came to the fore in the early 2000s was giving your yeast plenty of nutrient in the form of diammonium phosphate, which is great for yeast nutrient, but can give its own problems in that it then provides substrate, of course, for compounds to grow, in fact, including Britannomyces. Are you filtering? Now, filtering is a very tricky one. I mean, Parker's on record as saying he hates filtered wines. Of course, filtered wines will tend to be much more stable as to how much of the, how many of the aroma compounds and flavour compounds are filtered out is still the subject of great dispute. So many people say, yes, I like a natural wine with minimum intervention. And I say I like a technically excellent wine. Although I would point out, what is quite fascinating is that if you do a full technical analysis on an inexpensive wine and compare, let us say, for example, a Cru Classé Bordeaux, technically they're not that different.
I think I've said at the beginning, it's like I was absolutely amazed. And there's always for me like the kind of learning curve that like when I think I have understood something, then I pick up like something like your book and I understand how little I still know about wine. But I think it's fair to say that like your book on wine falls and flaws is really the reference, at least in my opinion. And I think I would leave it with that. But being cognizant of the time that we've already spend together, and it's like, as you said, I don't want to keep you all afternoon. Maybe I can ask you as a last question, which is something that is a bit of a personal issue for me as a WSET student. The problem of really identifying a fault or a flaw or the level of flaw that is still acceptable and what isn't, because obviously, it's a bit of a big call to say, like, this. You hear it often, this wine has cork, which might be something entirely different, or it's like, so, but what's the kind of guidance you can give?
It is a very tricky one. I did, back in my days as a wine buyer, we obviously did analysis of wines when they arrived, and sometimes we thought, is there a problem with this, or is it an acceptable level? Normally, we would return wine straight away to the producer. But once in a while, we thought, perhaps this is acceptable. Wines we got returned was fascinating. The wines that were returned as faulty, about 80% weren't. Okay? The wines we put out that perhaps had an indication of fault, very few ever got returned. Just looking at some warning signs. Sometimes we can see a fault. So if in the case of red wine, you've got a loss of colour and browning, or white wine, you've got some browning or flattered down appearance, the wine might well be oxidised. Certainly deepening the colour, and that can give light strike. A sludgy sediment you can find sometimes probably means the wine's been fermented in the bottle, which is something we haven't had time to discuss today. If you've got a cloudy appearance with some brown tinges, that can be heat damage, something else we haven't really discussed. Just an interesting aside there, Penfolds are still bottling Grange in bottle sealed with a natural cork as opposed to screw cap. And the reason they do that is that it can give the consumer an indication if the wine's suffering from heat damage. Because if the cork seems to have red wine all the way up it, it has pretty definitely suffered from heat damage as the wine has expanded and gone up the cork, or also if the cork is slightly raised. And some faults we get on the nose, I mean, obviously the so-called cork taint, the TCA and other haloanisoles. There are many others, the Brett compounds, the elastoplast, Band-Aid, the pooey animal, stable, smoky, we will normally smell that. If the wine smells burnt, it's probably oxidation. If the wine smells a little bit of vinegar, it's probably very high volatile acidity. If it smells a nail varnish, it's probably excess ethyl acetate, which also we haven't had time to discuss today. Other faults we can get on the palate and the same ones. Light strike can often manifest itself on the palate with a Marmite or Vegemite, as is marketed in some countries, or wet wool taste. If the wine has a particularly thin body, it can be subject to something called atypical aging, which is also a growing problem. If the wine actually tastes of vomit, heaven forbid, then it may result in some lactic acid bacteria. I think what I'm trying to say, though, is that if it tastes unduly odd, you know, suspect a fault straight away. If you're buying in a restaurant, then obviously immediately return to the sommelier or waiter. If you're buying in a shop, don't think twice about returning it. What I do caution, though, in an age when everybody is writing bad reviews on restaurants just so they get to get a free meal or something, is if you don't like the wine, you know you don't like it, don't take it back and say it's faulty. Not least because you've got it in the supermarket. The supermarket will give you another bottle, no problem, but they'll be charging the producer for analysis, for return, etc. And that is unfair. It's one of the sad things about today. I find the internet truly excellent for 1,001 things, disastrous from the point of view of everyone is an expert, they're doing their blogs and sometimes great, sometimes otherwise, but people's reviews. Actually, someone once wrote a bad book review and had a look. Oh, the Amazon delivery driver put it in the bin, you know. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. On that note, I suppose I could use the opportunity, I'll never have been a salesperson, to give a plug for the new book, Wine Faults and Flaws, A Practical Guide, Keith Granger, published by Winery. It is not cheap. I try to bridge the chasm between scientific works, which are unreadable to most lay readers, and readable works, which most scientists hate because they're full of anecdotes, etc. So there's both in this book, and I try and talk in very readable terms, or very understandable terms.
And it certainly is. I think that is something that is one of your strengths, is that you can explain very technical aspects in a very readable and understandable manner. And I would finish by saying that I once again recommend it to everyone who's serious about understanding wine faults and flaws. You rightly said we only scratched the surface. I think we could have talked for hours and hours. So like this is like you said, it might not be cheap, but there is a lot of information in this wonderful book. Lastly, I would like to say it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Keith. And once again, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Jochen. Hope to be back out in Südtirol before too long. So thank you so much.
Cheers. Well, that's all for today. As always, check out the show notes where you'll find additional information about this episode, the details about Keith Granger's books and where to get them. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave a review and make sure you subscribe to the podcast. Thanks for listening.